We lived in Brooklyn, New York. I was born in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant. And we had a big old house at 55 Hull Street, and in the attic of that house were books and papers and pictures, boxes of materials that we were not allowed to mess with. That applied to everybody else, not me.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Zora Neale Hurston is today one of the most revered writers in America, though she died in poverty and obscurity in Florida in 1960. Born in 1891, she earned several college degrees and became a novelist, folklorist, and anthropologist who traveled throughout the southern United States and the Caribbean collecting songs and stories. She was raised in the first incorporated black community in America, where she was insulated from the racism that afflicted American society. Hurston's best-known novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, was published in 1937. All of her books were out of print when she died and were only rediscovered with the growing strength of the women's movement and interest in women's studies and African-American studies on college campuses. Oprah Winfrey presented a film version of Their Eyes Were Watching God on network television in the U.S. in March 2005.
Their Eyes Were Watching God was a book that I read when I was 9 years old for the first time.
Lucy Ann Hurston is the daughter of Zora's youngest brother. She has just published a book about her aunt called Speak So You Can Speak Again. It includes a CD with 24 tracks of radio interviews Zora did in the 1930s.
My father is Everett Hurston. He's Zora's baby brother, the last Hurston born, the true Hurston born in Eatonville, unlike Zora. Zora was born in Notasauga, Alabama, January 7, 1891. She claimed Eatonville as her home, and I think it's because it gave her her personality, her development. It helped to create that which was Zora. I was a crazed reader my entire life. I went to private Catholic school. We'd have a spelling book and a math workbook and, you know, all these academic books that we would get about two-thirds through when school was on. Now, I had two sisters and a brother, and they couldn't wait for school to be out to toss those books aside and get on with the business of doing summer. I was thrilled when summer came because I could then, at my leisure, finish working in those books. And then I would spend the rest of my time at the Brooklyn Public Library, where I loved to check out books, two and three at a time, and maybe return one. I had this thing about owning books, okay? I read it, I liked it, I wanted it, it was mine. The library had some rule about you have to bring them back. So I remember that when I was 9 years old that summer, they suspended my library privileges. Well, just kill me, okay? What to do now? I reread my entire Bobbsey Twin collection, reread my entire Hardy Boys collection, but then I remembered there were these books in the attic. And while Daddy was out in the yard cutting grass and stuff, I would sneak up to the attic. And I would sit with these books, and I'd be very careful to turn the page, because if you folded the corner just the wrong way, it kind of snapped off in your hand, right? And there were these old brown, hard pictures, cardboard-like, oval and brown. And I would sit up there, and I would go through these letters that were in envelopes. I would look over these pictures. I would read from these books out loud, because the words had commas in them and stuff, and you couldn't get the sense from just looking at them. You had to hear them. And I loved it. And I found this book signed by this author who was fortunate enough, I thought, at 9, to have my last name. And I read this book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I wanted to know whose eyes and what were they looking at. And when they looked at God, what did they see? And did God see them looking back at them? I read this book, and I managed to go in 3 visits to read this entire book, 3 secret visits to the attic. I read the book. But I was going to explode. I had to tell somebody about it. I had to talk about it. I had questions. And I went to my father, and I asked him, "Who's that lady with my name that wrote that book?" And after he gave me the stern, stern discussion about touching Zora's stuff, he proceeded to tell me about Zora. And how weird she was, and how strange she was, and how great she was, and that she had such important things to say that they put it in books. And that moved me, because I had always heard that people had important things to say, or what that person said was important, or what that person said was so insightful. But I never knew anybody whose words were so important that they printed them down, bound them, and put them in a book. And this book from the 1930s became a very important piece of information in my life. And I read it again, and I read it again. But I never heard of Zora. In all my schooling, in all my education, I never heard of Zora. I went to St. Benedict's in Brooklyn, New York, moved from there in 69 to Connecticut, went to St. Anthony's in Bristol, went to Bristol Central High School, never heard of Zora. And I thought she was our little secret. It was me and Daddy and Zora. And words that she wrote that were so important were printed in this one book, and that one book was in my attic. And it was a ways after, right? I graduated high school, never went to college. Nobody ever told me to go to college then. So I didn't go. And I waited till I was 31, and I went then. But a long while after, I started hearing about Zora from other people. And I got real defensive, right? What do they know about my auntie? What are they talking about my auntie for? And then I realized that, okay, as much as Zora touched me, she touched a lot of other people too. And that, surprisingly, I wasn't the only person with her book. And others didn't have it in their attic, they had it on their bookshelf.
You're listening to Lucy Ann Hurston speak about her aunt, novelist and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston.
Zora was a product of her environment, truly. And she was fortunate enough to have the environment of Eatonville to shape her. It helped her to create a well inside of herself, and it showed her that those places were good. It did not show her that she was disadvantaged by her race or gender. In fact, it made her embrace it. It became her life's work. The examination and the display of that which was black and that which was female. And she found all the good in that. In making Janie, she gave us a strong, black, determined woman who, up against specific odds, still succeeded in that she created what was important to her. She goes into an arranged marriage at the bequest of her grandmother, who is really trying to do what is best for her in positioning her in the world for safety, for comfort, to be propertied, to be respected as a wife. Okay, so it's Logan Killex. And he's old, and he's crotchety, and he's crusty, okay? And she's looking for beauty and flower and roses and bees in the pear tree, and she doesn't find it there. She goes then to be the wife of and the property of her next husband, Jody Starks. She tries it out and decides, this isn't working. It's all about Jody. Her entire existence was about Jody and being a piece of his property. She defies the expectations of the 40-something-year-old woman that she is when she takes up with Tea Cake, Virgil Woods. But she does what makes her happy. And she's not worried about what she puts on for the world. That very much is Zora's life. There is more of Zora in The Eyes of Watching God than there is in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road. She drew from herself for Janie and for the circumstances. Indeed, she places them in Eatonville. And the importance of Eatonville in shaping Zora is also what helped shape Janie. 28 black men were given a chunk of land in an attempt to tie them to the South and stop the northward migration in the late 1800s. Those men who it was expected that they would fail, those men had been taught secretly against the law to read and write. And when they were given that property in 1888, they ran immediately to Orlando, the seat of power for Florida, and incorporated that town so that it could not be taken from them. There was the start of Eatonville. In The Eyes of Watching God, that is the start of Eatonville. The man that taught those newly freed slaves to read and to write, risking his life, was Josiah Eaton. It is for him that Eatonville is named. My grandfather, the Reverend John C. Hurston, and his wife, Lucy Ann Hurston, my grandmother, showed up there shortly after this town was incorporated, and the first building to go up was church, okay? The seat of power in the town is Moral Order Church. Next building to go up in the town? No, school was done at home. School became an industry after industrialization, okay? Jail. So we're gonna exercise some social control over you through the church, through moral order, and if that fails, we're gonna lock you up, okay? First sheriff in the town was the Reverend John C. Hurston. Okay, so he was the law. This book is 5 years in the making. Speak so you can speak again. What made it fun was having to relive all of the stories that Daddy told me. Having full permission now to wallow through the boxes and share with everybody else the joy of the articles that I found in the attic in Brooklyn, New York. And 2 years of wandering around gathering materials. I was 3 years old when Zora died. I did not know her. I am told I met her once, and how many of you know something that you did at 3 years old? But as a researcher, what I know is where to find stuff. And I know that my father being the last Hurston born, he was born in 1898. He was 60 when I was born. Go Daddy. I know that I have first cousins alive that know Zora, that met Zora, and that their stories are just as important. So, with my father being the last of Zora's family, I turned to my first cousins, who were in their 80s, and my second cousins, and my third cousins, and I went and investigated and interviewed all of them and put their input, their stories, the family perspective for the first time, collaboratively, into this book. So I spent 2 years wandering around, being in the space where Zora was. Everywhere where she had a home, where she wrote a story, where she had a relationship, where she had a houseboat, everywhere she was, I was in her space, breathing her air, walking her steps, so that I could feel it. And then there's the last 3 years of work on the book, which is the write, rewrite, you know. How many of us are grad students? Oh my God. Right. So that was a couple of years for that. And then we brought in Malika Adera, who's an editor, to tie the stories together from all of these different generations of families in one tone and put that in. The wonderful thing about this book, if you know Zora, this gives you another dimension to her. You now have her handwriting, you now have her voice. For the first time, you can hear Zora speak.
You ought to hear Zora Neale Hurston tell the story of when she went around to get this folklore, and she was just out of Barnard, and what was it you'd say, Zora Neale?
I would go and ask the people. I was very conscious of my Barnard education and my Barnard English. And I would go to some of these common people to get Negro folk stories, and I'd say, do you know any of those folk tales? I'm searching for some folk tales. Mm-hmm. I ain't never heard about them. Maybe
that's
they
wonderful.
Heard about it over there in Sanford, or maybe in the next county. I ain't never heard nothing about it.
Lucy Ann Hurston is the daughter of Zora's youngest brother. She has just published a book about her aunt called Speak So You Can Speak Again. It includes a CD with 24 tracks of radio interviews Zora did in the 1930s and folk songs she recorded.
Mama Don't Want No Peas No Rice is a song from Nassau, the Bahama Islands. They're great song makers, and their tunes are decidedly more African than the ones made by the Negroes in America. They make songs so rapidly, they say, anything you do, we put you in sing. And in a few hours, they have a song about it. And Mama Don't Want No Peas No Rice is about a woman that wants to stay drunk all the time, and her husband is really complaining about it. He's explaining to the neighbors what's the matter with his wife and why they don't get along better. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. Make up my bed last night over the wall, over the wall. Make up my bed last night over the wall, over the wall. Make up my bed last night over the wall. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. Mama don't feel so very good across the chest, oh, mama don't feel so very good across the chest. Mama don't feel so very good across the chest. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. Oh, mama, she went to bed last night feeling cold, feeling cold. Mama, she went to bed last night feeling cold, feeling cold. Mama, she went to bed last night feeling cold. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. Oh, mama, don't drink no gin because it causes sin, it causes sin. Oh, mama, don't drink no gin because it causes sin, it causes sin. Mama, don't drink no gin because it causes sin. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. Oh, mama, she said to Papa, he is getting old, he's getting old. Mama, she said to Papa, he is getting old, getting old. Mama, she said to Papa, he is getting old. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time. So Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Oh, Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil. All she wants is whiskey brandy all the time.
When do they sing a song like that?
They sing it at their dances, the jumping dances, the fire dances, and whatnot.
Novelist and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston. Lucy Ann Hurston is the daughter of Zora's youngest brother. She has just published a book about her aunt called Speak So You Can Speak Again.
The last piece of work that Zora worked on was with her in Fort Pierce, where she died. And we almost lost it because they were setting all of her property on fire, which is what they did when you died in a county welfare home. And they took all of her materials out in the yard and they lit a fire with them. And it was a sheriff, a local sheriff that had come frequently to visit her, that stopped them and made them put that fire out and save the last of her documents. So as I have my charred remains, the last remains, the last piece of creative work by Zora in its original charred form is also included in here. She worked until the end of her life. She sketched, she drew, she wrote plays, she wrote manuscripts. She worked for Paramount Studios in California for a while. Let me introduce you to who I know as Zora Neale Hurston. Zora Neale Hurston ignites passion. Once introduced to her stories, those she told and those told about her, people want more. Her life comes together like a garden, thick with orange and mango trees, jasmine, stones, waterways, all tending her way. Hers was a life rich with tension, intriguing down to its final details. She was born on January 7th, 1891, not years later as she would have most folk believe. While passing oneself off as younger might be a common tendency among women, Zora Neale Hurston was in no other way average. At a time when a woman would be praised for educating herself just enough to become a teacher or marrying sensibly and becoming a wife and mother, Zora climbed over those aspirations and became a sterling writer. Zora is now officially recognized as a significant contributor to culture internationally. In addition to her fiction credits, she was an anthropologist, a playwright, folklorist, journalist, activist, and initiate of Neo-African religious tradition. She thought and acted like a feminist before the term was even coined. Zora was born at the right time and came of age in the right place to achieve all that she did. She was born at the turn of the 19th century among the second generation of African Americans free of chattel slavery. Had she been born a generation before, her talent and intelligence would surely have gone unrealized. And just a generation later, the traditions she documented, such as work songs, stories, and rituals, would have passed with the lives of blacks in the rural South and from the memory of blacks who moved on to the cities of the North. Zora's parents, the children of slaves, took their family beyond the mental and physical boundaries of the plantation. They rejected sharecropping as an improved version of unfree labor and looked for a place to create a self-determined life. The Hurstons were among the fortunate African American families to find and settle into a place among their own. They raised Zora in an organized town founded and run by people who looked like her and shared her history. It was perhaps this rich community that allowed Zora, the child, to be an outgoing spirit, a girl who played against type, as rough and tumble as her brothers. She evolved into a dynamic, pioneering woman who sometimes wore feminine hats and dresses, and sometimes pants and ties. She smoked cigarettes and drove long distances alone. She would go on to expeditions in foreign lands, and she would live by herself at a time when a woman living alone was unthinkable. Zora Neale Hurston was recognized in her own time as a major talent by book industry institutions. She was charismatic and challenging, sometimes considered special and provocative to friends and adversaries. The quality of her work as a scholar earned her respect among academics, and her writing won her favor with the general reader. She captured the hearts and minds of readers with 5 novels, 2 collections of folklore, an autobiography, plays, and numerous essay stories and articles. Contemporary scholars, writers, and literary critics include her in the canon of American literature, and her work is now taught in schools and universities. Many great literary figures, including Pulitzer Prize laureate Toni Morrison, consider Hurston one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. Despite how well regarded her work was, Zora struggled financially before, during, and after the peak of her popularity. Like millions, she survived the Great Depression and the racial apartheid of the times. Like many, she wore the scars of hardship. Unlike many, she continued to aspire, to grow, and to create. Still, by the time she died in 1960, all of her books were out of print and stayed that way for 2 more decades. A small circle of writers, scholars, teachers, and critics, many part of the Black arts movement of the 1960s and 70s, kept Zora's memory alive by sharing what they knew of her out-of-print work. It was this community of activists, cultural workers, and educators who talked Zora up in their conferences and classrooms, advocating that her work be made widely available. Darwin Turner, who once taught Hurston as a professor of literature, instigated the republication of Mules and Men in 1970, and Larry Neal, poet, critic, and central figure in the Black arts movement, did the same for Jonas Gordvine, which was published the following year. Alice Walker had first heard of Zora while attending a class taught by Margaret Walker Alexander at Jackson State University in Mississippi. Walker then introduced herself to Zora's work in late 1970 while searching for material on traditional religious practices by rural Southern blacks in the 1930s. She read Mules and Men and found it perfect not only for the purpose of providing background information for the story she was writing, but for conveying a sense of black people as complete, complex, undiminished human beings, a sense, she said, of that which is lacking in so much black writing and literature. It was Robert Hemingway's groundbreaking book, Zora Neale Hurston, A Literary Biography, that led Alice Walker to go to Fort Pierce, Florida, in search of Zora's unmarked grave in August 1973, where she was perpetrating being me. Finding the grave was a profound moment for Walker, and she documented it in an article that appeared 2 years later in Ms. Magazine. This article led to the publication of the Zora Neale Hurston Reader, t- titled I Love Myself When I Am Laughing and Then Again When I Am Looking Mean and Impressive, edited by Alice Walker and Mary Helen Washington. And so the Hurston Literary Renaissance began. Book by book, the novels, essays, and collections of folklore were made available to new generations of readers. The 1990 edition of Their Eyes Are Watching God has sold more than 5 million copies. And all of Zora's other major works are currently in print. In 1990, the inaugural annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival was launched. And in 1993, the city of Fort Pierce built the Zora Neale Hurston Branch Library. In 1996, Zora became the fourth African American and only the fifth woman ever to be published in the Distinguished Library of America series. And since the printing of this book, we can now add many other firsts to that, like the postage stamp that had Zora's image on it that came out 2 years ago. Many aspects of Zora's life and work have been examined and written about from a scholarly perspective. But as Darwin Turner wrote in the foreword to the 1970 edition of Mules and Men, Zora Neale Hurston herself should have been a character in a folktale, but an author would not dare create her. Readers and critics would denounce him for inventing such an unbelievable person. While Speak So You Can Speak Again is not a folktale with Zora as the main character, it is the first collaborative family-sanctioned project on the life and legend of Zora Neale Hurston. And as such, it renders Zora's life in a more intimate way than the biographies, essays, and articles that have preceded it. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you listen to Zora sing.
That was Lucy Ann Hurston, who just wrote a book about her aunt, the novelist, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston. Her book includes a CD with 24 tracks. In this, Zora explains how she invents new words.
You know, some of your words I love. Do you remember how you say friended with?
Yes. Making verbs out of nouns.
Yes.
We do that a lot.
She was friended with. What's that one about? Putting your foot up?
Putting your foot up and when you get ready to really play the dozens with somebody. Lay them out, you see?
Play the dozens.
And so you go to the house and you put your foot up on the step, you see, and one hand in your hip, and then you really tell them what you think about them and all the folks way back for five or six generations. And maybe like the old man was a double hump camel and the mom was a mule.
That'll do. Don't say any more. You remember what Willie said in the control room. Well, but is that putting your foot up?
Yes, that's putting your foot up on them.
Oh.
You see, you intend to be very emphatic when you put your foot up.
What's specifying?
Oh, well, that's giving all the details. They use that sort of loosely. Sometimes a person is talking a lot or giving the details, you know, really low-rating in front of the public, you know, and they'll say, ain't she specifying? Telling all about them.
Novelist and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston. I'm Melinda Tuhus for Wings.
Wings is a weekly radio program by and about women around the world. For more information, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil.